Greetings and salutations. This is AC2GS, and my name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and I am net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong since 1982. It's on every Sunday night at 8 p.m. here on this repeater, and I hope that all of you will join me for another episode of it. Let me remind everyone of the usual things before we get down to the net. If you need to contact me and you can't get me on the radio, then email is a good way of doing it. So if you have any questions you want to ask, any topics you want to hear discussed, any puzzles you want to share, or if you'd like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a NASA or space-related bit of news and comment, the email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, my call sign is AlphaCharlie2GulfSierra.com. Every week I put up a whole bunch of interesting links at which you can peruse at your leisure. The first few don't lend themselves too well to discussing on a radio because they're visual in many ways, or they're space-related and Paul will handle it. So those are the top first few links, and the rest on the bottom are things that I would talk about if we did the Science Talk segment, which occasionally we do dip into once in a while. But if not, they're available for you to peruse. They'll be available for the next year or so. So anytime you want to, you go to your browser, type in roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll get you to the link page. There's a chat room. You can either go through Limark's own website and find the link there and type it in and click it, or you can type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. And as I've mentioned before, I try to make available a live link to the W2VL repeater on the Internet. So if you do not have a radio and you'd like to listen in to what's going on, just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and most of the time it will be giving you a stream of the Glen Oaks repeater. And as always, want to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a wonderful archive of technical nets going as far back as September 2006. His website is amateurradio.tv. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you my plans for tonight. Okie doke. As always, I will ask people if they have any questions of a technical nature hit that push to talk and give me their first name and their call sign, and I'll put them down on a list, and we'll try and do it in an orderly fashion. Sometime around 8:30, 8:45, we will call Andy, WA2CDL, into Andy's corner, and he has an intriguing series of technical discussions regarding the repair of radio equipment, which he has done for a great deal of his life, and he's a wizard of it, and I'm looking forward to that. So that'll be around 8:30, 8:45. When he's done with his wizardry, I'll come back and continue if there are any questions that remained, or ask for any further questions. Okay, I think I'm not getting through to the repeater again, so can someone give me a signal check?
Yeah, Roy went down. Hold on.
Currently connected to reflector 9126.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club.
1-9-2-8-7-9-6
on the New England Reflector.
Link clear. The node that you called is not responding.
Hey, Roy, it looks like I lost connectivity to Plainview from the computer end.
Well, this happened a couple of weeks ago as well, and after a while it timed out. Do you think there's any chance for that, or am I screwed?
Yeah, I remember it happened before.
Good evening, this is
K2CJ. Hold on a second.
Is there a text?
Yeah, you're hearing it through my other receiver. I cannot connect. I can't get into the Windows machine, can't get into the Linux machine, so connectivity went down there. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we can do. Can you want to go on Echo Link, Rory?
Let me see. You know, sometimes propagation is vaguely tolerable. Some days are better than other days. Let me try giving full power on the IC7100, and you'll tell me how noisy I am. How's that?
All righty, give it a shot.
Hello, everyone. This is AC2GS. Does anyone actually hear me?
Roger, Roger. This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Joe from Harrison, New York. Yeah, I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay, that's good. So am I full quieting? If not, how much noise is in the background? Give me an idea.
Roger, Roger. Loud and clear. Full spiel on my meter over here. Coming in crystal clear over here, all the way from Harrison, New York. Roger, Roger.
Okay, very good. So I guess we can go on with the show. Anyone else want to tell me how my signal is?
Just fine, Roy, W2ASC.
Okay, very good. I mean, I've had this experience before where the propagation works and I get through and then something weird happens and I drop away. So no guarantees for tonight, but we'll try our best. I'm glad to be back on the Glen Oaks repeater for a change. I hope it stays alive and well for my transmissions. As I was stating before the link got screwed up, after about 8:30, 8:45, we will ask Andy to come by for Andy's Corner. He has an intriguing series of insight into technical repair that he has done for most of his life, and it is a very valuable bit of information that he shares with us on these weekly presentations, and I'm looking forward to it. That will go for as long as it goes, and I will return to finish up the questions, if there are any, and at around 10:15 or so, I will turn the mic over to Paul, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report. That should take us approximately to 11 p.m. And at that point, I'll wish everyone well, put a bow on it, and call it a night. So that's my plans if the repeater continues to be receiving my signal. We'll work with it as time goes by. If anyone wants to ask any questions of topical nature, this is the time and the place. Hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, just listening.
Okay, Rich, glad to have you aboard. Anyone else with any questions or topics for tonight? Give me your first name and your call sign.
E2EPP, listening.
Okay, thank you for that. Anyone else with any questions of a technical nature tonight? Please give me your first name and your call sign.
It's Roy Sam, KQ2NSJ. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers there out there. All you guys have wives, mothers, daughters. Congratulations. yeah, Roy, I have a question about this land ground plane antenna. You know, it goes onto an antenna and it has four legs to it. What does it really do?
Okay, Sam, you're number two on the launch pad. If you have the time, I think I'm going to take Rocco first because he's the first guy who came in with a question, and then we'll get to you as well right after. Is that okay with you, Sam?
Oh, no, no problem. Put me in the right order. Yeah, I just was trying to tell you what I wanted to ask.
Okay, very good. So, Rocco, you're first. What's your question for tonight?
Thank you, Roy. My question is regarding setting up a small antenna to do QRP on my 705. I've tried a couple of small external antennas. I've even tried an antenna, a VHF antenna tuner, you know, with the random wire. I've tried other antennas that I can use for portable usage. My X50 Diamond works just fine. I get an SWR of about one, a little over one. But on any antenna I take out in the field, I just can't seem to get an SWR below three. Back to you.
Okay. I'm a little confused, though. The 705 is a very a nice-looking radio. It's a software-defined radio. But my understanding was that it doesn't do UHF, VHF. It only does HF. So my assumption is you are using a mechanically shortened antenna and then lengthening it electronically in some way with a tuner or some such.
No, I'm using the 705 to do basically 2 meters. And when I use it with my home antenna, it works just fine. I get an SWR of a little over one. But when I take it out in the field and I want to use it outside, basically with a couple of different antennas I've tried, anything from random wire to small antennas, even with an antenna tuner, I can't seem to get, even with a counterpoise, I can't seem to get an SWR below 3. So I was wondering if you had any kind of recommendations. I've used it on the net. It works just fine with my home antenna. I'm getting like an SWR a little over 1. Back to you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, unfortunately, I had it mixed up with the 730. What is the 7300? I didn't mix it up with the 7300. That's just an HF. The 705 is an all-in-one. So I'm not quite sure why, though. But did you use the same exact antennas and they're just located in different places?
So at home, I have a couple of diamond antennas that, you know, I have outside, and you know, I use this radio on the net, and I hook it up to my home antennas, and I'm getting, you know, SWRs of one. It works just fine. But when I take the radio out in the field and I want something that's portable and compact, anything I've tried that's small, from sticks and, you know, these magic sticks, and I've even tried it with a 2 meter tuner, I can't seem to get an SWR with a counterpoise of less than about 3. Back to you.
Okay, that's a very, very curious thing. You would sort of think that if you used antennas that were resonant, have you tried different types of things? Like, I don't know if you have a magnetic mount antenna that you use in your car. Have you tried to kind of use that as a means? Or What specific, you mentioned a dipole and a commercial antenna that you used both on the outside. What were they again?
On the outside, I used just a 2-meter random wire with a tuner. I used a little dipole. I forget what brand it was. I even used this other thing called a signal stick, I believe it's called. And, you know, with a counterpoise of about 2 meters or so, no matter what I try, even moving the counterpoise around a little bit, it drops the SWR a little bit. But I just can't get any SWR that's really on under 3. So I was just wondering if you had any antenna suggestions, or you might suggest that, you know, another workaround that I could use when I'm out in the field, because I want something compact for a backpack. Back to you.
Okay. How much elevation did you give these antennas when you were trying them?
I probably didn't get much up above 6 feet, whatever I could get to the closest tree, and then just tacked the tip of the antenna up to the tree. Back to you.
Okay, well, you know, as we repeatedly mentioned, and Dick, K2RIW, you always mentioned, you know, UHF and VHF does best with high elevation. You get a much better signal if you can raise it as high as you can. I had my first antenna was a Radio Shack quarter wave ground plane, very inexpensive thing. I stuck it on my basement awning. So it had a big 6 feet of elevation, and the signal was not good at all. When I was able to raise it on a pole, it got decidedly better. I eventually just swapped it for a much better antenna. So I'm thinking maybe there's some ground coupling going on that's part of the problem. With a lot of mobile antennas, they're physically low to the ground, but they're better shielded by the metal of a car, whereas this is just sitting on a tree, and so it might be coupling to the ground a little too much. I would just it's always nice to have a mag mount in case of emergencies. You know, if you want to take a handy talkie in your car, I don't know if you have a mobile radio in your car, and so, you know, you can get a cookie dish and just kind of mount that someplace, and sometimes that's all that you need to get through. It depends upon how close to the ground it is and if it's an unencumbered horizon. You know, if you have a lot of buildings around you, that can cause problems as well. Why it's such a bad visual is at this point a mystery, unless it's coupling to the ground, and that might be what's going on. So have you ever tried any of these things near your house and wired to your internal radios and been able to measure what goes on with them? They just might be faulty designs that your antenna tuner simply can't correct for. You know, antenna tuners can be limited in their ability to match unmatched pieces of wire.
Thanks. I'm just wondering, the last question with that is, I'm just wondering if I have a proper counterpoise or a proper ground even, because, you know, I have played around with the counterpoise length and positioning, and it does seem to lower it a little bit. That's the only way I can really get it to come down. I will raise the antenna a little more, but do you have any suggestions about the counterpoise?
Usually counterpoises are approximately less than a quarter of a wavelength in length, you know, something like an eighth of a wavelength. Some people have a slightly different length that they like. You only need something like 3 as a minimum to get an omnidirectional pattern. And again, it's more of a function of how close to the ground. If you get it way too close to the ground, you need a lot more than 3 because you have to shield it from ground coupling. But as you bring it down to the earth, or you bend. Also, you can try bending the ground planes. Sometimes if you give them a turn down to something as far as, you know, instead of 90 degrees off the axis of the vertical, you can bring it down to as low as 45 degrees from the bottom. And that will also lower your impedance for a given frequency. So you might want to try that too.
Okay, thank you very much. I am going to try a couple of those things. And I really appreciate the help and all the help you give us on the tech net on Sunday night. Thank you very much. Back to net.
Okay, well, you're welcome, Rocco, and I appreciate your participation in the tech net as well. Sam, you wanted to ask me about a similar type of a thing. What's the radials for, I think, was your question.
Yeah, thank you, Roy. It's a LAN. It's a type of counterpoint. It connects to the bottom of your antenna, goes around, and has four legs 20 inches each to go. They say it's for ground plane, but how does it really work?
Okay, we sort of discussed some of this a few weeks ago. Someone who didn't really like the answer, the generic answer, and didn't like that there's no nice equation that you could plug things in and get an answer. It's more of an experimental concept. But the short form explanation of what's going on is a quarter wave vertical is really half of a half wave dipole. And the way to get around not needing the other half of the dipole is to set up something at the midpoint that acts almost as a virtual mirror for the one element that you do have, so that there's the quarter wavelength vertical element, and then there is an electronic reflection that's caused from theoretically, it's an infinitely long conducting surface at the end of that quarter wavelength radiating vertical. But because you can get away with murder sometimes with physics, it doesn't have to be a solid infinite conducting material, a sheet. It can be just a few legs coming off at approximately 90 degrees. So as far as the RF is concerned, that acts as a sort of a mirror and produces a virtual opposing counterpoise element that is not really there. It's a virtual dipole, if you will. It's a monopole that's in real life, but by putting the ground planes at right angles, you are producing an imaginary mirror image of another monopole on the other side, so it acts sort of like a half of a dipole. So that's what the ground planes are acting as. If you only have one ground plane, you're not going to get an omnidirectional radiation from the antenna. It's going to favor the direction of that ground plane conductor. So in order to have a omnidirectional all around 360 degrees, you need at least three ground plane wires at right angles at about 160 degrees from each other, in order to 180 degrees from each other, to kind of spread out the radiation pattern. If you're going to put it very, very close to the ground, there's another problem in which the radio waves you're trying to send out are going to get sucked into the ground and warm up the earth. So you would need more ground planes to act also as a shield against ground coupling. But, you know, that's the short version of what ground planes are. I hope that helped.
Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I guess I timed out the repeater in addition. Sam, did you understand what I was saying? And if not, or if I was cut short, please let me know where it cut me off.
KU2NFJ. No, you did a beautiful job, boy. Thank you. So, the question is, would you buy it? Do I need it? Or just to help your quarter weight get out a little better?
If you have a quarter wave antenna, you need some form of a counterpoise. If you do not supply your own counterpoise, nature will grab one despite you. What sometimes people do is either they don't supply a counterpoise of any kind, or they supply one that is not enough for the system. And so what ends up happening is your antenna takes on your transmission line and uses it as a counterpoise. Sometimes that's not a terrible problem, but sometimes what it leads to is you get RF going back down in common mode in your coaxial cable, which you usually don't want. You don't want your transmission line to radiate. You want it to just put the power into the antenna. And it can also put a lot of RF into your shack, which can make your computers reset, make your radio reset, produce a lot of background noise, all kinds of problems. So Mother Nature wants a counterpoise. Either you give it to Mother Nature or Mother Nature will take it from you.
Gotcha. Even if I'm in the attic, right? Okay, Roy, thank you. Now I understand the counterpoise. I really didn't understand it before. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Sam. I'm glad I could explain it to you, and I'm glad that you are participating in the technical net. I enjoy, participation. That's most of what this technical net is all about. So I thank you, Sam, and thank you, Rocco. It's now 8:32, so probably a good time to summon Andy from one corner to another and ask him to come on the net and give us this edition of Andy's Corner.
Okay, Willie, thank you. And welcome to Andy's Corner. This is WHCDL. My name is Andy. And I think my audio is going to be a little better this week. I changed back to my Kenwood radio for my Yaesu, which had really terrible audio last week. So, I was listening earlier, and I did come to the conclusion that the link, for some reason, between the way things were set up went down, and I guess I know Lou's doing a good job in getting it back. Anyway, so welcome to Andy's Corner, and see it's around 8:30. So, I will continue in my discussion about troubleshooting and repair, which I started last week when I mentioned about being a CB-er back in the 60s, and being curious on how radio works and what it does, and being able to open it up and look into it and watching the tube glow, I thought I'd be more interested in finding out how it works in case it stopped working so I could fix it, you know, which I trained myself, basically. And a lot of experience over the years, for sure. Yeah, now, troubleshooting is an art, basically, and most people know what troubleshooting and repair is about. There's plenty of YouTube videos on this, which you can look up, and I'm sure quite a few people have looked into the different aspects of troubleshooting and repair, from amateur radio to test equipment to whatever they want to fix. But there are multiple levels of troubleshooting, especially in this day and age, because we live in this solid-state age of service mount components, which you can hardly see. And it really takes a lot of skill. So I'm really focusing on basic troubleshooting, nothing advanced. And I'm going to be talking about, which I started last week, or troubleshooting tube type equipment. You know, because tubes are easier to see. And other than touching it with your fingers and hopefully not getting burned, you can remove a tube pretty easily. Much more easily than removing a solid-state device. So I'm going to be concentrating on that. I'm not going to go into troubleshooting some of the latest radios that are out on the market because that's really a head-scratcher. If you do buy one of the newer radios and it starts malfunctioning for whatever reason, most of the time if you're able to get a schematic for it, it's pages and pages of schematics, and they even make the schematics tiny where you can hardly even see from one point to another. So I like the big wide open schematics that I can trace out the circuitry and see what's going on. So anyway, I'm going to be concentrating on that, on the old stuff, and then later on we can slowly transition to some of the newer devices which were incorporated into the newer radios. As far as troubleshooting, we can get into some of the basics with that. All right, I know everybody's listening with bated breath and how to troubleshoot a radio, but really, the way I learned was, one of the first things I learned was how to read a schematic diagram. So you really have to know your way around a schematic, because the schematic is basically the map that you use for troubleshooting. That's why they give you a schematic, so you can see how the circuit is designed. And along with the schematic, you have a good manual or service manual on a piece of equipment. They will also give you what is called a block diagram. And with a block diagram, you can actually trace out the signal flow from one block to another. And the reason why they call it a block diagram is because they take a section of circuitry and they put it in a square or rectangle or what have you, making it, you know, resemble a block. And then that square is connected by a wire or a bunch of wires to another square, and then it's connected to another square, and so on, and until it reaches the end of the line. And that basically shows the signal flow of where it starts from the antenna to where it ends at the speaker. And that's on the receive side, or for the transmit side, from your microphone that you're going to talk into, through the circuitry to the antenna. Obviously, you'll be transmitting a signal. So the block diagrams show that in their own way, which you can look at and sort of like figure out, okay, what block performs what function. So when I started troubleshooting, I used both block diagrams and schematic diagrams, and, you know, understanding that within itself, to try to figure out, you know, what is wrong with the piece of equipment that I'm working on. And if it's a transceiver, there's some basic questions that I ask myself. What is it not doing that it's supposed to do? But obviously it's got some problem with it. Either maybe it's not putting out any power at all, no RF power, or there's no audio coming from the microphone, or maybe it's just not receiving, or maybe it's receiving on the wrong frequency. So there's many things that can happen. And you really have to, you know, understand the basics of what it's supposed to do, and then from there you can start. Yeah, one of the things that I started collecting way back when was some basic equipment, test equipment, so I can do some troubleshooting. So I could inject a signal, or I can look at a signal, or I can read a voltage, or I can read a current, and so on. And, of course, both, I say of course, because I'm just assuming, but I would think that most amateur operators would have at least a watt meter, hopefully a dummy load, so they can measure their power, and not transmit on the air, but put it into a good 50-ohm load. And with that, hopefully they would have just a basic meter, a multimeter, which is not expensive at all. You can get those pretty cheap. And that would be used for, you know, measuring voltages, if you have to measure a voltage, or measure a current, if you want to measure a current, and so on. So that's, so the two essential things. I think the most essential would be the multimeter itself, which could be, and I'm using the word multimeter because both digital meters are multimeters. They measure resistance, they measure current, they measure ohms, and some of your analog meters, which are also helpful, like the good old Simpson 260, which is a workhorse of a meter. It's been around for many, many years. And it's one of the basic tools needed for any kind of, you know, basic troubleshooting and repair. The problem is, if you don't have any equipment at all, if you have no way of measuring anything, then you really don't know, you know, what to do, or you don't know what to look for. In the case of if they give you on a schematic diagram a certain voltage that you got to measure, and if you don't have a piece of equipment to measure it, then how do you know what the voltage is? So I think that would be one of the basic things to get. If anyone is interested in doing any basic troubleshooting, and even in the automotive industry, it's the same thing. You know, you got to use basic tools to even tune up your car's engine. So you got to have some basic tools, which I'm just mentioning. And of course, when it comes to transmitting, you know, it's good to have a watt meter so you can actually measure your power in watts, because that's what it's measured in. It's measured in watts. And going into a good load, and usually it's a 50-ohm load, because that would match the impedance. Most rigs have a 50-ohm impedance, either looking into the connector, which is the SO239 in the back of the rig, or in the front of the rig, and also the output impedance would be 50 ohms, going into a piece of 50-ohm cable, going into your 50-ohm antenna. So the basic law is when impedances are matched, you get the maximum power transfer. So you want to keep everything matched for that reason. So it's good to have a good 50-ohm watt meter, which most watt meters are. They do make watt meters that are used in other industries, like for cable, for instance. Your cable in your house is not 50 ohms, it's 75 ohms. And there's equipment that is designed to measure 75-ohm frequency, 75-ohm cable, and whatever you want to look at on a cable going into your house. But for amateur service, it's always, in most cases, 50 ohms. And of course, depending on the antenna that you use, because the antenna itself, you know, a dipole has a different impedance than 50 ohms. It's actually 72 ohms if it's high enough. So you have to, you know, match it with a little transformer to match the impedance to get your maximum power transfer. But we'll concentrate on the actual troubleshooting at this point. So I'm just giving you like an overview of how things are connected. Okay, so last week I spoke about one of the early CDs that I had in my possession, which was Pistol Controlled, 23-channel receives, and by the FCC rules regulations, it's got a maximum input power. I'm using the word input of 5 watts because the FCC rated equipment is not as power coming out, but as power going in. What I mean by that is the actual circuitry, the way it's designed, has a certain power input, which, again, the FCC describes and specifies as 5 watts input. And because of the design of the stages, there is some losses, you know, due to the efficiency, and basically efficiency is output over input. So the actual power out coming out of a CB radio, and I'm using CB as an example, is about between 2.5 and 3.5 watts or so, you know, which is normal and meets the specification of having a 5-watt input radio. And we'll talk about that later as far as input and output, but I'm just mentioning it. So if you have, and I'm just using my CB as a guide here, because that's how I started. So just keep that in mind. So if you have a radio that transmitting with about 2.5 watts or 3 watts of power coming out, going into a watt meter, which is going into a dummy load, and it's on the right frequency, determined by the crystal that's installed, you got half the battle solved because you're transmitting on the frequency, which is not what it's supposed to do. But let's say there's pick up the microphone and you push the talk on the microphone and you call somebody and nobody hears you. Nobody's coming back. So we'll start from there and let's see if we can figure this out. All right, so as I just said, you're going to connect a watt meter to the radio and see if it's putting out any power, any RF power going into your antenna. Now, and that's also assuming that you are receiving, because you are able to receive stations, but they're not hearing you when you talk. So, you know, how do you start? Where do you go from here? Again, you have a microphone which transduces your voice energy into an electrical signal, which then goes into the radio, which usually goes into a microphone amplifier, which amplifies it to some degree. Okay, now, you know, again, I'm using some basic equipment. I did not mention an oscilloscope. An oscilloscope is a very handy thing to have, and it would be advisable to have one, especially one that would receive the signal that you're transmitting on. And in this case, I went out and bought a Tektronix. I bought it brand new. I bought the model known as a T935. You can find them on eBay for just really peanuts. They're not expensive. It's a basic scope made by Tektronix, which is a great company. And I bought mine back in the 70s. And it had a, this mine that I bought has a 35 megacycle bandwidth, which means it can actually receive an RF signal up to 35 megacycles. And I'm only saying this because we're talking about a microphone problem, so here's where an oscilloscope would help in locating the cause of nobody hearing you. So we have to see if there's a microphone problem. It could be something else. We're starting with, we know it's transmitting, we know it's receiving, but nobody's hearing. So I'm starting from there. and I left out one important thing.
NGWB2EAV.
Yes, Ed, you're going to probably say, take a receiver, put it on the frequency, and see if you hear yourself. Because I didn't mention that. I was going to, but I didn't mention it yet. What did you want to hear?
I am not going to say that. You just did, and I agree 100%. But the reason I interrupted you is I just bought from Amazon a Hantech, H-A-N-T-E-K, 70 megahertz, dual-channel, digital storage oscilloscope that in our day ended with thousands and thousands of dollars for the princely sum of $250.
Very good. Yep. Prices of the oscilloscopes have come down tremendously because of the technology involved and large-scale integration and everything being integrated circuits. Yes. I could tell you, I paid for my Tektronix, when I bought it new, about $1,100. That's what they went for. And this was back in the 70s. And $1,100 was a lot of money. So yes, you could get them a lot cheaper. And the only reason why I mentioned my scope is because that was the first one, the first real good scope that I bought. Which by the way, I still have in my possession, and it works fine. I did have to replace a filter cap because it did develop a hum. And you're going to say, okay, I'm getting a little bit off the course here. How does an oscilloscope hum? Well, it actually doesn't generate a hum where you can hear it, but you can see it on the scope trace, where the scope trace was not a straight line. There was a little bit of what I call ripple on that line. And I knew there was a power supply issue. And it was getting worse and worse. So I had to replace a bad filter capacitor in the power supply, and that cleared the problem. Okay. Very good, Ed, and thanks. Yeah, you could, for people who are interested in doing a little troubleshooting, and if you want to go out and buy yourself a simple multimeter, so you could measure some voltages, or an oscilloscope, because again, they're not that expensive compared to the one that I bought way back when. They've come down in price, and although you could buy an oscilloscope for $60,000, which they do sell, but they go up, they do a lot more things, and they go up to a much higher bandwidth. So, but I don't think that's necessary in this case. Okay, so, let's see, and continuing just, basic troubleshooting, so we have a radio that, we're talking into a microphone, but nobody hears us. All right, so what I did mention before, which really I should have said in the beginning, because really the first thing to do is if you have a receiver that would receive the same signal that you're transmitting on, and if you could possibly hear yourself, but let's say you don't. Let's say you are able to tune in, and you're going to hear what's known as a dead carrier. And a dead carrier will sound like a quieting signal in the receiver that you're receiving. And if the receiver has a meter on it, like an S meter, a signal strength meter, you'll be able to see that meter move when you tune in to the frequency that you're transmitting on. So, again, you're connected to a watt meter, so you know it's putting out power. But again, as I said, nobody's hearing you. So, if you tune in, and if you have a receiver that would be able to do that, and let's say you don't hear any audio. You're talking into a microphone, but you don't hear anything. You hear and possibly see the carrier on a meter on the receiver, but you don't hear any audio at all. audio is known as modulation. You don't hear any modulation. It is just very quiet. So, as an example, with this particular scenario, you could start right at the microphone. And if you have a simple multimeter, not even an oscilloscope, and if you know how to use a multimeter on the lowest scale that you could measure, and that would be in the millivolt scale, because most meters go down to millivolts. 1,000 millivolts is 1 volt, 500 millivolts is 0.5 volt, and so on. Microphone cartridges, microphone elements, put out a very low signal. However, if you connect your meter across a microphone element, and again, I'm going back to the CB days, so we're not talking about elements that are powered like electric elements that they use now and so on. I'm talking about the older type crystal or ceramic cartridges that they used in microphones because they were popular. And they put out roughly around a, measured in dB, minus 55, minus 60 dB or so. But let's say that you have a bad element, and that's what you're going to figure out if your element is bad. So there's a number of different ways in measuring the element. You can obviously open up the microphone, and you can see where the wires are connected to the element, and you can place your meter, your multimeter, in the millivolt range right across it, right across the element, and then if you give a whistle or talk into the microphone element, you should see your multimeter move to some degree, showing that your element is working and receiving your audio from your voice. You're seeing your voice modulation because you see a change on the multimeter that you're measuring, using to measure it. Okay, now if you also want to do a little bit more investigating, you could see if the microphone, in this case, has a plug at the end of it that plugs into the radio. You can measure it at the plug end to see if you see a signal, an audio signal there. Because maybe you have, maybe your element is good, but the cord from the microphone to the plug may be bad, which happens, especially these coil cords. You know, you stretch them out and you retract them and you stretch them over time, and they do go bad. They become scratchy, and sometimes you lose your audio completely, and it turns out to be a bad microphone cord. I've replaced many of them over the years. Microphone cords are rugged, but they're not as rugged as a telephone-type cord. The coil cord on your old phones, your wall phones, were made out of a special wire that could handle the stretching and retracting over and over and over again. And I forget what the name of that wire is. There was a special name for it. But it was a more rugged cord. And very rarely would they go bad. But in ordinary microphone coil cords, hand microphones, I see this all the time. We have, you know, the coil cord itself could cause the problem that we described. Okay. So, you know, as I say, I'm making this up as I go along. Let's say you are now measuring at the microphone plug with your multimeter, or if you have an oscilloscope, like Ed mentioned, that's even better, because with an oscilloscope, you'll be able to see, you put your probe on the audio leads going to the cartridge, and again, you go to a millivolt scale or even a 1 volt scale on your oscilloscope. I'm assuming you know how to use the basic functions of an oscilloscope. I'm not going to go into the talk or dissertation on, you know, test equipment and how to use that, because that's a whole other subject. But let's say you know how to use an oscilloscope and you measure at the microphone plug, and you see audio coming from your microphone. Okay, you see audio from the microphone, but still nobody hears you, and you're not hearing it coming out of the when you transmit. So now you say, well, it's not the mic. There's something in the radio that's causing it. Okay. So these CB radios operated in the either sideband or AM modes. I'm just inserting that now. But we're going to just discuss a little bit about AM, which is amplitude modulation, because sideband gets a little bit more involved in circuitry. But with amplitude modulation, or AM, which is what I had an AM, and that's the mode we use. There is no FM on CB, as far as I know. It's not a mode. It's only AM. And there's no CW either. So, AM is the mode that we use. And, of course, like the name says, amplitude modulation is what happens. Your RF power output will vary with audio peaks, thereby, you know, increasing the amplitude of your signal. And that's very basic, but that's what AM is. And there's different kinds of AM. There's high-level AM, there's low-level AM, depending on the circuits that's involved. But I just thought I'd mention that. But as far as troubleshooting is concerned, we're just going to start from the beginning and see where we are losing the audio that we're not hearing. Okay, now, again, I'm going to concentrate on a tube radio, because tubes are a lot easier to see and to identify than transistors. Sometimes even looking at a schematic, because transistors are so small, sometimes you can't even find it. You don't even know where it is. But a tube sticks out, and you'll know, okay, here's a tube. Let's see what's going on with that. Now, the only thing you got to keep in mind, if you're not aware of it, is the voltages that are used in tubes are much higher than the voltages used in transistors. You could have a battery-operated radio that has tubes, and they did make 1-volt tubes to do that. But the battery, normally, when I say 1-volt tubes, I'm talking about the filament. But the tubes had a second battery called the B battery that is designated as a B term, as for a higher voltage battery that would supply voltage to the tubes. But in this case, and we are using household current, the radio is plugged into the wall socket, and it's got a built-in power supply, which supplies the voltages to the radio. And you just have to be careful if you're going to probe or look underneath the chassis and see where all the components are. Just be careful not to touch anything, because some of those connections have a voltage which will give you a nasty shock. And we're not really talking about high voltages, like in a final amplifier of a transmitter, like a 6146, where that has normally 800 volts on the plate. We're talking about voltages more in the 200 to 300 volt range or so. So it's, and I've gotten a jolt or two over time just by accidentally touching a point. So you just got to be, you got to keep that in mind. Whenever you're working on a piece of equipment, you got to maintain respect for high voltages.